This episode was recorded in 2021. From Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, Sanjeev Yajnik, President of Financial Services at Capital One.
What I found to my surprise is that many of the skills that I had developed all the way from my marine engineering days and Pepsi and Circuit City, all of those were transferable into this company that was massively entrepreneurial at that point. It still is, 22 years later. We were doing things that had never been created before.
How a young man from Calcutta, India, went from 13 years at sea to becoming the president of financial services at one of America's most prominent banks. Sanjeev Yajnik's first job, or first career even, was as a marine engineer, sailing the world for huge shipping companies. For more than a decade, he was often at sea more than on land. His all-in approach to fixing and building ships, solving engineering issues, and working cross-culturally catapulted him up the ranks and eventually led him to do something totally risky, to give up a promising career in India and move to Canada to start over and find a brand new career path. Today, Sanjeev's a part of Capital One's executive team, leading a company whose annual revenue went from $19 billion in 2010 to over $31.5 billion just last year. Sanjeev's known for his purpose-driven leadership, a nimble approach to risk management, and turning around businesses. But his story really begins back when he was a boy in India, where he says the strength of his family, the Catholic school he attended, and even a little help from a future Nobel Prize winner totally impacted how he thinks about the world and the personal and professional choices he's made.
My childhood initially was just a cocoon. I had a very loving family and very focused on the arts and academics. And when I went to school and when I was in what we call junior school, so elementary school, I had the opportunity to actually visit an orphanage in Calcutta. So the school I went to was St. Xavier's.
This was a Jesuit school?
It's a Jesuit school. And one of the people who would come to the school very often, in fact, we saw her pretty much every other day, was Mother Teresa.
Wow.
You know, at that point, she was Sister Teresa. And so we visited an orphanage with her. I remember this was when I was in the fourth grade. And there was one particular event, actually, that really changed the way I thought about things. I tripped and fell, and there was a boy around my age who fell with me. So I fell on him, and we both fell to the ground. And when I looked into his eyes, I saw myself. And for a moment, I saw that it was me lying on the other side. And when I went home, I started thinking, why is he there and why am I here? Who is the I in me? Why did he deserve to be in the orphanage? And it really shook me up. And I started asking my parents a whole bunch of questions. And I think it really shaped the way I think about the world. You know, I never took anything for granted. And look, I grew up in a, you know, a middle-class family.
Yeah.
And we didn't have very much. But I used to think that we had everything. You know, there was a lot of love and laughter. But, you know, Mother Teresa at that time was just like an aunt to us. All of us who grew up in St. Xavier's and went to school, she was there all the time. We used to complain to her. And she would always turn around, and she always spoke in like three or four word sentences, like work harder and do good things. Just step outside your door and find someone to be good to. Those kinds of things. And we never ever, you know, dreamt that she would be as famous as she is. But it also didn't surprise us, I don't think, for all of us who grew up with her, because she was just that kind of a person.
Right. You would go on to study marine engineering, and you became a marine engineer. I think in your, you know, just as from what I understand, just as you were about to begin your career as a shipping engineer, marine engineer, your father passed away very unexpectedly. What do you remember about that time?
Well, it was a traumatic time. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to be a marine engineer was by the time I got through high school, I'd never been outside of India. And I really wanted to work and see the world, and this gave me an opportunity. My father was my best friend. I mean, he was just unbelievable, just such a great person, very loving father, but also demanding of excellence. And in those days, they didn't really want to tell us that something had happened with the family because we were at sea and, you know, the ship needed us. But I finally found out that something was wrong when I was in Indonesia. And I left the ship and found my way back to Calcutta. That was a really tough journey. But it was hard. It was really hard on me. It was hard on the family.
Did that have an impact on how you thought about your life and your career? I mean, were there things that you had to now do or take on because of the death of your father? Were there responsibilities you had to your mom, to the rest of the family?
I think that was my growing up moment, Guy. You know, when my father passed away, I knew I was pretty much alone and I had responsibilities to the family. Now, I have an elder brother and a younger sister, but I've always been a little more leaning in on taking care of everyone. And it was a traumatic experience. But I knew I had to grow up really fast when that happened. And look, he was not even 50 when he passed away.
Yeah, and you were a young man. I mean, I think in your early 20s. And at the time you're working, was, I think, for India's biggest shipping company. Tell me what life at sea was like. I presume you were on, like, cargo ships?
Yeah, I worked on container ships, dry cargo, crude oil carriers. Mm-hmm. The days were really, really busy, and it was an unbelievable experience.
This was, I think it was like 6 years you would be at sea, more or less.
Actually, the total time that I spent was about 13 years. But we would be, you know, both at sea, but also building ships
right
in different ports. And we worked together with other engineers, and we were trying to figure out how to bring many of the concepts of quality engineering into the work that we did.
I'm curious about just about one aspect, many aspects, actually, of life at sea, because, I mean, you were a young man, right? And you are living, it's a community of people who are together for a concentrated amount of time. And it's probably long days and not great sleep and not great food. What was just a typical day like for you during that time?
Yeah, one of the great things about shipping at that time and being an engineer, by the way, is that at that point, we didn't have satellite navigation. We didn't have communications with ashore other than shortwave radio. We had two magnetic compasses and a gyro compass. In fact, one of the ships that I was on, the magnetic compasses went on the bump, the gyro went on the bump. It was overcast, so we couldn't take sextant readings. And we kind of lost our way on the way to Australia. And we ran out of water. We had to take the water that we had in a ballast tank and sift out all the sediment, boil it with potassium permanganate and drink that. So it was a very different kind of life than the life that some of the marine engineers have today.
Yeah.
But look, the days were very busy. On a ship, everyone has a schedule, and so you're on a watch. And so as a junior engineer, normally one would have like a 12 to 4 in the evening and 12 midnight to 4 in the morning. And then after the watch, there's other work to be done. So in one of the 8-hour breaks, you try to get some sleep. But it was incredibly busy, but for me, incredibly liberating, incredible fun. And we would be hitting ports every, 7 to 12 days. But there was a tremendous amount of variety of work to be done on the ship. And then finally, Guy, if something went wrong out at sea, you had to fix it.
Yeah.
There wasn't a call a friend helpline, right. Figure something out. We used to have some of these fun games of, dismantling a turbocharger and how fast can you do it? Can you just close your eyes and imagine what comes after what? Mm. But for me, it was just a tremendous amount of fun taking the concepts of engineering, but actually seeing it at work.
Imagine at that time in your life, you would see your sort of future trajectory as an engineer and as sort of a maybe, over the course of your career, maybe becoming a manager, but in an engineering capacity, because that was what you were doing, right?
That's right. And I actually ended up in Mobile Oil becoming, I think, at that time, the youngest chief engineer in the fleet. And so I loved engineering. I still love engineering. I mean, that's what I was passionate about. But I guess I hit my, the highest level I could get to on the ships at too early an age. Which really started me thinking about what else do I want to do.
So I guess you decide to, you had been sort of living kind of overseas anyway, and I think primarily in Asia. But 1990, you moved to Canada with your wife and your very small child. Tell me about that decision to kind of uproot your career and your life and to go to Canada.
This was just a pretty unbelievable adventure. And when I look back at it, I would advise my children never to do what I did. because of my job, I saw my daughter when she was just about born till she was 1 month old. Then I had to leave. I saw her again when she was about 8 months old for about a month and a half. Then I had to leave again. And I saw her when she was just over a year old. Hmm. So I knew that I had to do something to try to be with the family.
That was not the life that you had signed up for.
Yeah, I realized that, I think about myself as a dad. I mean, that's right. My primary way that I think about myself. And so the way we finally ended up in Canada is a bit of a miracle. I heard that the Canadian consulate was in Calcutta. And so unannounced, I end up at the consulate. Mm. There was a whole bunch of people sitting around. And so I run into this place and I tell the assistant outside of his office, I said, I really need to see the consulate because he really wants me in Canada. Mm. And so she laughed at me and said, look, you've got to fill in the thing and there's a point system and you've got to wait and the waiting list is like 4 years long. The consulate walks out of the office. He asked me, what's going on? I said, you really need to see me because you really want me in Canada. And for some reason, Guy, he turns around to his assistant and says, I have 5 minutes. So I sat down and I said, look, I'm an engineer. And I said, I'm passionate about building things and I will be an asset to Canada. And at the end of 5 minutes, he turns around and gives me a package and says, fill this up. It'll take you a few months to do that. And just mail it in to me and we'll see what we can do.
Wow.
And so I took that package. I told my wife that she was not going to see me for a while. And I did all-nighters and we literally filled up that whole thing with a small business plan of what I would do. And before we left, I went back right before the consul general was leaving. Mm. And I said, I've done it. And he was very surprised. 9 or 10 months later, we get our immigration papers. So it was a miracle.
That's amazing.
And oh, by the way, we had no relatives in Canada. We had no friends. I had no idea what I was going to do.
Wow. I mean, you leave your career behind, the successful career, and you move to Canada. And you, I guess, decide to enroll in business school to get an MBA because that, at least, I guess, your thinking was that would give you some options.
Yes. So I was leaning much more towards starting up a business,
right,
a marine engineering business. But while I was sailing, I decided that I might as well do my GMAT and apply to colleges because that's another way to find out what I really wanted to do. And so I did it on the fly in a port. My application was all done by my wife running around and getting my papers organized. And I would call her from different ports to get the papers done so that we could mail them in. And so when we landed in Canada, I had no idea whether I had admission to any school. Hmm. We decided to visit a couple of cities. And then I started calling the universities to find out whether I was admitted to any of the programs. Because they didn't have an address that
right.
they could send anything to.
Right.
And to my surprise, I had admission to the ones that I had applied to.
Hmm.
And then the question was, which one should we go to? And we made a call to one of our family friends who lived in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And he said, you definitely want to go to the Ivy Business School in London, Ontario.
The University of Western Ontario.
That's right. And so we drove into London, my one-year-old daughter sitting in the car. I ran into the library. I asked the librarian to show me that this was a really good university or, you know, what it was ranked in Canada. It was ranked number one. We said, okay, this is where we need to be. And so we started our life in Canada in an empty apartment
wow.
with nothing in it.
When we come back in just a moment, how Sanjeev's move to Canada pays off and how he learns firsthand how a company should not react to tremendous change. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. This episode is brought to you by Dataiku, the AI platform that connects data and doers through everyday AI. Every day, Dataiku customers are turning complex data into tangible results, fueling use cases from the mundane to the moonshot. Because it's only data until you make it a business strategy or challenge an entire industry. Without you, it's just data. Visit dataiku.com to learn more.
The following message comes from NPR sponsor, Aspiration. After over a decade working in climate action, Andre Cherney started a personal finance company to help people use their dollars as a force for positive change.
Today, a lot of people want to be part of the fight against climate change, but they don't know where to start. And with Aspiration, we're able to give people ways to have easy, automated climate impact built into what they're already doing every day.
Visit aspiration.com today to learn more.
Hey, welcome back to Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. So it's the early 90s. Sanjeev Yajnik and his family are set up in Canada, and he's got a new degree, a new job, and a new plan.
I graduated from my MBA program right in a recession in Canada. But I knew that I wanted to build things.
Yeah.
I really wanted to build things. And the other thing I really wanted to do was understand business from the ground up. And so the wonderful thing about Pepsi is that they took a chance on me. They gave a tremendous amount of leeway. And I had an opportunity to build the restaurant business in Canada from scratch. I mean, we had a few restaurants there, but because the job entailed everything from soup to nuts. It's like hire the people, find the locations, work with the company to set them up, and then manage the whole territory. It was the hands-on kind of an approach to business. What I also loved about it was I was meeting people and working with people that were, you know, the salt of the earth kind of a thing. Mm. They were the strength of Canada. And really understanding them, understanding their families, understanding, you know, the hardships and the triumphs that they went through was such an amazing, amazing experience. I would never change it or exchange it for anything.
And you spend about 4 years with PepsiCo until you go to Circuit City. And did you stay in Canada or did you move to the United States at that point?
At that point, we moved to the United States. So I was running the Canadian operation, but also upstate New York.
Right.
So as I started working in the U.S., I was just blown away by the opportunities, the vastness of the country, and the wonderful way in which, you know, I could make that country my own as well. And at that point, Circuit City was the darling of Wall Street. It was the largest consumer electronics company in the United States. And it was just a very exciting opportunity. It also had more of the technical pieces of the puzzle, you know, merchandising, but of consumer electronics. So that kind of drew me to the company as well.
I remember buying my first CD player at Circuit City when I was a kid. Circuit City is now held up as a, you know, one of these sort of brands like Pan Am or, you know, TWA and a few others. Why do you think, I mean, Best Buy is around and thriving, actually. Why do you think Circuit City failed?
You know, my 2 years at Circuit City were like a new MBA. And because I worked very closely with the CEO, Rick Sharp, who was an amazing, amazing leader and a visionary. And he was the one who really put Circuit City on the map. And in fact, the learnings that I've, you know, that I got from there have been a constant haunt, where I believe that successful companies sow the seeds of their failure right in their success. Mm-hmm. So, I actually worked with the CEO on some of the strategy elements while we were also creating CarMax and other things. And we noticed Best Buy. And what we noticed was, at that time, Best Buy was not doing well at all. In fact, it had a near-death experience, I think, in 97. But we noticed that more customers were walking into Best Buy than Circuit City. Because the business of consumer electronics was going through a major change. So Circuit City's entire strategy was around having salespeople advising you.
Right.
However, the change was much more to like get a shopping cart and just put your $99, you know, DVD player in there. Mm. And the company, Circuit City, was run by people who had come through the sales organization. And it was inconceivable to the management that, you know, you have a store that is purely merchandise, but you don't have the sales component.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, Circuit City was an amazing company. The sales organization was probably one of the best in the world. And I learned a lot from that as well. But, you know, the learnings of how successful companies fail when you have a tremendous amount of change that comes on you has been a lesson that I have never, ever forgotten.
You took that with you, knowing that essentially that there was a failure at a certain level among the leadership at Circuit City to see where the industry was headed?
Actually, Guy, we could clearly see where the industry was headed. Hmm. Rick Sharp said that in a leadership meeting. He said, look, there are more customers walking into the Best Buy than into Circuit City. The question is, you can see that, But can you change the trajectory of a company where every process, every calendar of every person is tuned to the optimization of what made it successful in the past? And that change needs a combination in my mind of leadership and management.
Yeah.
And you don't get to be the darling of Wall Street, the best returning company, you know, the largest consumer electronics retailer without great talent. When change happens, it takes something else, a different kind of, I think, leadership management drive to essentially change the engine on the plane while it's still flying.
You were in Richmond, which is where Circuit City was headquartered, I think. And so I guess this is how you ended up at Capital One in 1998, because Capital One is also headquartered in Richmond, right?
Yes. Well, that it's a bit of a funny story, because I was not interested in financial services or in a bank, because I always thought about banks in general, you know, as a place where you've got to do routine stuff.
Right, boring.
Boring.
Yeah.
But a couple of my friends, some colleagues, classmates from my MBA program, wanted to join Capital One. And I'd never really heard about the company. So I took their resumes, and because I was in Richmond, I forwarded it to the head of HR. And I just gave the head of HR a call and said, you know, they're really bright. They want to look into your company. And Capital One was very small at that point. It was just about starting up. And so he turns around and says, what about you? What's your background? And I gave him the background. He said, why don't you come and see us? And I said, no, I'm not interested in financial services. And, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I like to build things. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, why don't you just come and visit with us and maybe you'll find something interesting. He convinced me to go through the interview process, which I found very exciting, actually. It's like case studies and problem solving and all the things that I love. And 6 months later, I was sold and I joined Capital One, never having been in financial services, never having been, you know, in a bank or done risk management. But the founders of Capital One took a chance on me, and that's how I ended up here.
Wow. So you joined Capital One, and this begins your sort of very long career with the company. You're still with them today, obviously. And what did you encounter when you got there? I mean, it was obviously a much bigger organization today than it was in 1998. But what was your charge? What were you tasked with from the beginning?
Yeah, Capital One, you know, became a company in late 94, early 95. So it was a very young company, very few people, everyone pretty much knew everyone else. I was put in charge of risk management, which is really profiling customers, loss mitigation strategies, loss assessment, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I had told the folks, I said, you realize I've never done this work before. But what I found to my surprise is that much of my engineering, mathematics, and things like that came into play. And many of the skills that I had developed all the way from my marine engineering days and Pepsi and Circuit City, all of those were transferable into this company that was massively entrepreneurial at that point. It still is 22 years later. But we were discovering things and we were creating things. We were doing things that had never been created before.
Like what?
Using data and information and statistical modeling to be able to give better products. Mm-hmm. And so the thing that really drew me to Capital One is that our values and our mission were very aligned. And that was, we were going to use our brains to help the customer. We're going to use our brains not to enrich ourselves. Of course, you need to make profits and be a viable company, but we are going to get a fair profit for doing something amazing. And so the innovation was really using data. That was in the very early days of the credit bureaus and things, but we used to collect a lot of data. We used to use a whole bunch of statistical methods to then come up with the right sloping of risk. And so that we could give the right product, like we used to say, at the right time, at the right price to the right person. It's kind of a mass customization of the financial products and make it more affordable for everyone. And that was a great innovation, by the way, of our founder.
When you, I know that, and we're going to fast forward a little bit here, but you would go on to lead different parts of the organization in Canada and in Europe. But I want to ask you about the financial crisis that begins in 2008, 2009. What do you remember about that time? I mean, was there a sense of fear at that time?
Well, here's the situation. I was running Capital One Europe. So I was there for 3 years working in the UK. And I was then going to transfer over to the US to come and run the auto business.
Auto loans.
So auto finance. Mm-hmm. And it was a small business at that point. We were trying to figure out how to run it. Mm-hmm. On January, I believe it was January 5th of 2008, all of our furniture is on a ship headed to the United States. My family's in the other room. I get a call, and it is basically, we probably need to shut down auto finance. And so I did the single best thing that I could to save my family life, which is I didn't mention a word of that to my wife and my kids. So when I arrived in Dallas, I came here to shut the business down.
Wow.
And, you know, people were really worried because it's not like you lose a job, you find another job. The world was coming apart.
Right.
But when I came here, we saw a few things in the business that I really liked. And I've shut down many businesses. If they don't work, they need to get shut down because otherwise it is not fair to anyone. You know, most of all the people working in it.
Right.
But we saw something and we convinced our founder and CEO, who was supportive, and the board gave us a small window of time.
Wow.
But that period of time was literally on the edge because it was for all the people who worked in the business and myself, it was, you know, there was a good possibility that it wouldn't work out and we would be staring down the abyss.
Your job was to shut down the auto loan, the auto financing part of the business, presumably because the fear was that there would be so many defaults.
Actually, we were still trying to figure out the strategy for the business. Mm-hmm. It was not formed. And we had to, you know, we took a different tack when we restarted it. It's almost like rebirthing the business. Mm. And at that point for banks, the big issue was capital. You know, for any bank to survive and succeed, all the banks needed to really shore up the capital so that it could pay for defaults and so on and so forth. So the reason to shut it down was not that, you know, the defaults were going to come through no matter what. You couldn't walk away from that. But it was much more about preserving the organization so that one could move ahead in the future.
When we come back after the break, Sanjeev's experiences leading the hard-hit auto financing division delivered another lesson on running a successful business. Hint, numbers aren't the only measure. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. Hey, welcome back to Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. So after the 2008 downturn, Sanjeev turned around a new business at Capital One that was literally on the ropes. Unsurprisingly, he was promoted to head the company's expanding financial services division, in charge of over 5,000 employees. I want to talk to you about culture, because I know that, that culture has been a huge part of what you have focused on as a leader. So let's kind of dive into that. I mean, I know that there are a variety of approaches and strategies and philosophies around culture. Let's just kind of sort of big picture, take a big picture look at it. If you were to define your philosophy around company culture, where would you start? How would you begin to define it?
I think I would, you know, I would say that culture and values are so interconnected, and they all start at the top. And in many ways, culture is an expression of the values, right?
Right.
There's a saying in one of the Upanishads that always kind of resonated with me, which is, you are your deep driving desires. As are your desires, so is your will. As is your will, so are your deeds. As are your deeds, so is your destiny. But, you know, it starts with the desires, and it starts with, you know, what the values are. And if I had to tell you personally what I feel drives my orientation towards the culture that we want to create, I believe that getting together and building something for profit economically for the sake of something bigger than ourselves, so not merely for profits. I mean, you need it to exist, but the second thing that really drives me is the people. Like, the journey is the important thing, is not the destination.
Mm.
And, you know, that people who work with me must do really well with financial stability, having a place where they feel fulfilled, having a fun time doing the thing that we spend a lot of our life doing, which is working. So that is, like, incredibly important, that we actually do that and we do it together.
You know, obviously this show is, a lot of the show is about leadership. And oftentimes in our culture, we focus on visionaries, people who sort of set an agenda, and we credit them with great achievements and success. But I wonder if we give too much credit to vision and leadership and not enough credit to the actual management of that vision and leadership.
You know, I think it is a tough thing to separate out leadership and management.
Mm.
And the way I would put it is, if you go into a room of people and you ask for ideas of what could be done to make things much better, you get a tremendous amount of ideas, some really good ideas. And I've not been in a situation where there's a lack of ideas, but the rare commodity for me is the combination of having, you know, yearning to make something happen, seeing a future that one can almost kind of create, you know, mentally, but then having the guts and the courage to act on it and to make it real.
Hmm.
I don't separate out, you know, there's leadership and management and there's some easy delineations between the two. I think you have to have both.
Hmm.
And, you know, there's so many elements to this, Guy, but, you know, the key elements for me is being able to dream and almost, like, see it and taste it and you know, envision it. Having the courage then to actually act on it and having some of the wherewithal to put an organization together. And even if it's an organization of one, is yourself, to be able to make it happen and to create it and to shape it.
Mm.
And that's the beauty and joy of life, I think.
You have written something I think is so incisive. And I want to sort of dive into this idea with you for a moment, that you believe most teams are over-led but under-managed. Tell me a bit more about that idea.
Yes. I do believe that most teams are overled and undermanaged. And I think that it is because of the literature that separates out leadership and management. Mm. There are too many people, very bright people, who feel like what I do is strategy and I'll figure out what the vision is and then I'll delegate it to a bunch of people and they'll just execute on that vision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'll work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's never worked that way. And I personally call that play acting leadership. And in my observations of business, that doesn't lead to success. Mm-hmm. If you really want to have success, you really need to bring the combination of leadership and management and own both of those things and own it and be passionate about each one of those things. So that's, you know, I believe that most businesses are overled and undermanaged.
I wonder when it comes to management, it's something I think about because it really is a talent, right? It really is. And great managers, I'll admit, this is not a strong talent of mine. I know you are an amazing manager, but it's something I work really hard at and try to learn from great managers because I think that it is, you know, someone once said to me, and I think this is right, which is there really is no such thing as a company filled with weak or bad employees, but companies filled with weak or bad managers. And I think there's something to that idea, that you essentially can take unmotivated employees and make them incredible employees if they're well managed. But the corollary to that is that unmotivated employees with bad management will simply just get worse.
Well, you know, you're touching on a really important point. I've spent much of my career either starting up or turning around businesses. And what I find is that when I'm turning around a business that has that's on the brink of failure or that is failing, it's not because of the employees. It is this combination of leadership and management that is the failing point. And when I come into a business that I need to turn around or start from scratch, in all of my turnarounds, I do not let go all the previous people because I don't believe it is their fault. Mm. But what I would also say is that, you know, people, managers or leaders don't motivate people. People motivate themselves. But they only get motivated if the thing that we are collectively driving towards is something that resonates deep within them. Mm. And they have an opportunity to express themselves fully. If it doesn't resonate with the person, they're never going to be motivated.
Right.
You know?
Tell me, how did you begin to even manage the transition to work from home, you know, when the shutdowns began during the pandemic?
We had to make a pivot fast because what we wanted to make sure is that our associates were safe. And so we did what was necessary. We just rolled up our sleeves and we made it happen. You know, I think COVID has changed the world forever. And I think we are heading for a hybrid future where there'll be certain things that you really want to do in person. And there may be other things that one can do remote. I think these are really early days, Guy. Mm-hmm. And different companies are going to choose different strategies as the dust settles. And my feeling is that having the right organizational strategy and the way in which we work in the future is going to create a new set of winners and losers. Mm-hmm. We're going to learn a lot about remote work, the advantages, but also the disadvantages. And we're going to create the future of work by a tremendous amount of experiments that all sorts of companies are going to run.
Yeah.
And we'll see where it comes out.
Yeah. How do you think about, I mean, because the pandemic has kind of supercharged, let's say, changes in how we work, but also cultural changes that we are only beginning to see and understand now, and that we will certainly understand more clearly in the next decade and so on. How do you think organizations can make work more meaningful for people? You're seeing a lot of particularly younger workers coming out of college, and they're questioning the kind of traditional 40-hour or 50 or 60-hour work week and office culture, and asking themselves, is this what it's all about? Now, it's not clear to me whether this is a new iteration of a long-standing philosophical question that's existed certainly for some time, or whether this is something different. I suspect this is a little bit different, with younger people saying, what is the meaning of this? So if we are facing a future where particularly younger people coming out of colleges are, I think, asking fair questions about work and about the relationship between the employee and the organization, how do you begin to think about meeting those questions and answering those questions about meaning and work?
You know, Guy, it is a good question, but to answer that question, I actually have to peel away to what is the problem we are trying to solve. Right. So we are entering a new world right now. We need to embrace that. Technology today is not the same as technology even in, 2003, 4, 5, 6. It's very different. And so I believe that to be able to answer your question, our first step is that we've got to realize there's a new arena, there's a new future that awaits us that none of us have imagined. And I believe that the task of people, leaders, of all of us who are in these positions right now, is that we have to encourage and guide our organizations not to walk to the future, not to run to the future, but to make the jump. Get a whole bunch of bright, new, young people in, and then craft the future with them, because that's who the future belongs with. So I think the wrong thing to do is for you and I to sit down, certainly for myself to sit down and presuppose what success would look like. Hmm. I mean, 30, 40 years from now, they'll be leading a world which is so significantly different from anything that we've seen. You know, they are crafting that entire future in their minds. They're experimenting with it. We need to join that great experiment by helping them, by making the jump.
One of the things that struck me about you and your career, and something you've talked about, is that very early on in your career, you encountered and you were enriched by being exposed to people from different cultures and countries on the boats, working as an engineer in Japan. I mean, you were exposed to people from all around the world. And you've talked about how that has really actually made you better at what you do. Tell me a little bit about your approach to diversity and inclusion in your, not only, in what you do as a leader, but in the way you think about it as an asset.
Diversity is the thing that colors a black and white world. You know, it just adds so much enjoyment to our day-to-day lives. So, when I worked all over the world, it was just amazing to me. I mentioned that I'd never stepped out of India when I was growing up. Hmm. So the first time I got a chance to make a trip outside of India was when I was 21. And what I noticed as I worked across over 50 countries over the next 13 years is that on one level, we are so similar. We are just some of the hopes and dreams and just being human, the similarity, no matter where a person came from, no matter what their background was, no matter whether they were rich or poor, we are just so similar in our humanity. And then there are very important ways in which we are very different. There's cultures and ways in which one would think about certain things and traditions and all of that you know, really shapes the way in which different people thought. And so that's what I've carried, you know, with me. I believe that it is only through embracing diversity and having a diversity of thought of people. And by the way, diversity of thought is also driven by some of these visible and invisible diversities that we talk about nowadays. But only when you have all of that can you have, you know, a most enjoyable life experience. But also in business, what I've found is that that's when you have the most innovative, productive kind of outcomes.
When you think about your role as a leader, right, and you think about where you sort of came from and how you began your career, you did have leadership positions very early in your career at a very young age. Do you think that those qualities are natural qualities that you were born with, or do you think that you learned them over time?
It is very difficult for me to answer that question, Guy. The thing I would say is I don't have anything special. I'm just a normal person. And the one thing that I've grown up with, I believe in, is that one has to take responsibility, you know, for a situation and become your own leader in that situation. And I think everyone has that capacity, that no matter what situation one is in, to take stock, because there's good things and bad things.
Yeah.
You know, be your own CEO. You don't need a designation of a CEO. Everyone can be their own CEO. And oh, by the way, CEOs need help from time to time. It's not a bad thing. Look for help, look for advice. Graciously take help when it is given. And most of us are in a position where we can not only do things for ourselves, but importantly, do things for others. Taking whatever it is that we have, like skills and things that can be done, or ways in which we think about things, and that's a gift. And we can use that to make everything around us just a little better.
That's Sanjeev Yajnik, a marine engineer turned president of financial services at Capital One. And by the way, his efforts working on diversity issues in Texas, outside of his day-to-day work with Capital One, spurred the mayor of Plano to give Sanjeev the keys to the city. Thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR.